I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Today's Supreme Court confirmation hearing is like watching a tennis match. Democrats lobbing soft volleys at nominee Elena Kagan. Republicans going for that overhead smash. As expected, Kagan is taking some heat for restricting military recruiters on campus when she was dean of the Harvard Law School. Here's ranking member of the Senate Judiciary Committee, Republican Senator Jeff Sessions.
I'm just a little taken aback by the tone of your remarks because it's unconnected to reality. I know what happened at Harvard. I know you were an outspoken leader against the military policy. I know you acted without legal authority to reverse Harvard's policy and deny those military equal access to campus until you were threatened by the United States government of loss of federal funds.
This after Elena Kagan said she supported the military and had supported recruiting. Jay Newton Small of Time Magazine is covering the hearing. And Jay, we want to get back to the Harvard issue, but first of all, how do you think Kagan is doing?
Hey, Robin. Thanks for having me on. Sorry if you hear some background noise. I'm standing just outside of the hearing room in the Hart building, the Hart Senate building, where there's like in the atrium a lot of people around. But she's been, you know, pretty calm throughout the entire thing so far. The only sort of testiness was that one exchange with Sessions. But other than that, she's been smiling. She's been very at ease. She's been, you know, even cracking jokes every now and again with a couple of different senators. So far, she's been great.
But the testiest question was expected to be the one about the Harvard policy. So let's just hear a little more of some of these exchanges. And again, it was a Harvard University policy to restrict recruiting by any company on campus that discriminated in their practices. The military, of course, had the don't ask, don't tell policy. Here's Senator Patrick Leahy, a Democrat from Vermont, giving Kagan a chance to clear the air on the issue. Let's listen.
There's been this implication given, that's why I wanted you to clear this up, the implication given that somehow military recruiters couldn't recruit Harvard students. That was not the case. Is that correct?
That was not the case, Senator Leahy. The only question that ever came up, as you stated earlier, this was a balance for the law school because on the one hand, we wanted to make absolutely sure that our students had access to the military at all times. But we did have a very long standing, going back to the 1970s, anti-discrimination policy.
So, Jay, flesh that out for us a bit, because as we said, the school had the anti-discrimination policy. But Elena Kagan is said by some of her supporters to have figured out a way to abide by that policy, but also allow recruiting.
Indeed, when she did decide after the Third Circuit Court ruled against the Solomon Amendment, which is essentially don't ask, don't tell, saying or upholding the Solomon Amendment, basically saying that yes, you can, the military can employ this, you know, this strategy in order to exclude gays from the military. She basically said, okay, when that happened, we're going to bar military recruiters from the Harvard campus, from the official recruitment offices, because they won't sign the sheet of paper that basically says we don't discriminate. But we're going to encourage veterans groups to represent the military on campus and to recruit students. And in fact, she says that recruitment went up that year because the veterans groups did such a great job. Now, Senator Sessions, who's a ranking Republican on the Judiciary Committee, says that, you know, she was very, very virulent in her anti-military stances, that she actually never informed the Pentagon of her decision to suspend recruitment, that they were told about it much later on, that she was hostile in her treatment of the Pentagon. And he basically says that, you know, she's rewriting history by saying that she was actually friendly with veterans groups. And in fact, she really wasn't. She spoke at speeches and at rallies against the military. And so he actually is almost, we asked him afterwards, are you calling her a liar? And he said, well, I won't say liar, but I will say there's one version of the truth, and she doesn't seem to be telling it.
Okay, so that's the Harvard issue. But Senator Sessions also wanted Elena Kagan to comment on something that Joe Biden's chief of staff, Rob Klain, said. He said, Elena is clearly a legal progressive. Here she is, and Sessions asked her if she was. Here she is responding.
People should be allowed to label themselves. And that's, you know, I don't know what that label means, and so I guess I'm not going to characterize it one way or the other.
So, Jay Newton Small, a lot of questions as to exactly what kind of a justice Elena Kagan would be, because she hasn't been a sitting judge, and here someone trying to get at that. How else have people been trying to get her to get at how she will be a judge?
Well, she had this very interesting back and forth with actually Leahy early on, where she talked about, you know, there's two different kinds of judges, right? There's strict interpretationists, which are judges that are very conservative, and they believe in the letter of the law of the Constitution and really nothing else, and that the Constitution doesn't really age and change with time, and that it doesn't have any, there's no other way to interpret it, in fact. And then there's more liberal progressives, which is what Ron Klain was talking about, where they would interpret, they think that the Constitution is a living, breathing document that changes over time and can be interpreted in many different ways. And she basically took a middle route and said, in some cases, you know, when they say, for example, that a senator can't be less than 30 years old, it's a very rigid, strict interpretation of the Constitution. And in other cases, I think she believed that the Constitution was much more of a living, breathing document. For example, the Fourth Amendment, which allows no unreasonable search and seizures. Now, how do you define unreasonable? That's changed over time. You know, now we have sniffing guard dogs. We have, you know, heat-sensitive computers, things like that. So how do you change the interpretation of that rule? So she took a very much a middle line between the two different sides.
Well, Jay, just briefly, a few seconds, but she was also asked about a comment she made in the past about how Supreme Court nominees never say anything of note during the hearings, and she was asked about that, and she kind of implied, well, I've sort of changed my mind on that.
Yeah, it was kind of funny. Herb Kohl kind of pressed her on it, and he, you know, and she said, "Look, you know, I don't think it's wise for me to, you know, to talk about many of these cases. And now that I'm sitting in the hot seat myself, I realize that I was wrong, essentially, when I wrote that in 1995, and that it would make being a judge later on, prejudging these things, is very difficult."
So now that I am a nominee, I think it's wise not to say too much. Jay Newton Small of Time Magazine, covering today's confirmation hearings of Supreme Court nominee Elena Kagan, hearings that are expected to go on until at least Thursday. Jay, thanks so much, as always.
Thank you.
Well, today, North Korea called the nations of the G8 an evil group. This after the G8 condemned the sinking of that South Korean warship by North Korea back in March. And that sinking has ratcheted up tensions between the two countries, which, we remind ourselves, fought a war in the 1950s that was never formally ended. There was only a ceasefire, not a peace treaty. In the decades after and under the dictatorship of Kim Il-sung, North Korea's economy came to a halt as its backers, the Soviet Union and East Germany, fell. Finally, in the 1990s, a famine. People forced to take the bark off pine trees to use as flour. They picked kernels of undigested corn out of animal excrement for food. Journalist Barbara Demick wrote this detailed account of life inside North Korea after she spoke with six defectors who'd left the country. Her book is called Nothing to Envy, Ordinary Lives in North Korea. And today we want to revisit our conversation, especially with North Korea so in the news. Barbara told us that during the 80s and 90s, then dictator Kim Il-sung was able to convince people to abide by rules such as no family photos on the wall, only a photo of him and his son. I asked Barbara, how do you get people to follow rules like that?
You start brainwashing them from early childhood. The song, We Have Nothing to Envy in This World, from which I take the title of the book, is a very popular children's song. And in fact, many kindergartens have this slogan on the outside. And people are told that they live in the best country in the world, they have nothing to envy, that they're leaders are the equivalent of God. They've borrowed, you know, many of the images from Christianity. North Koreans are told that when Kim Jong-il, the present leader, was born, there was a bright star in the sky, a double rainbow. So this is the only voice you heard because their television stations are all affixed to a single government dial, and they don't hear any other viewpoints.
Well, and you do hear from, as you said, these six defectors who, it's like they were in a Truman world, like Jim Carrey in the film. You know, once they're out of the bubble, they go, oh, wow, look at that. But tell us more about what they said while they were in the bubble. You have, for instance, Mrs. Song. She worked in a factory, and her life just starts to unravel as North Korea starts to unravel with the fall of East Germany and then the Soviet Union, both of whom had helped prop up North Korea.
Mrs. Song is the person who I call the true believer. She came of age in the 1950s, 1960s, when North Korea was considered to be somewhat more prosperous than South Korea. And she was one of the ones who, you know, very joyfully dusted the portraits of Kim Il-sung and Kim Jong-il. She was the head of this people's group, the Imanbun, that had to spy on the neighbors. And, you know, she was so inculcated in these myths of North Korea that even after her family members started to die of starvation, first her mother-in-law, then her husband, then her only son, she wasn't able to blame the government. She felt it had to be her fault. And, you know, during the famine, the North Korean regime stepped up its propaganda. People were told that the reason there was no food was that the U.S. had a blockade. This was completely untrue. In fact, at a time, the U.S. was the largest food donor to North Korea.
And what was happening was that the military, in part, was stealing the donated food and, you know, selling it on the black market, so it wasn't getting to people.
Yes, in part. I mean, there also, you know, there was no food because the system had failed, the economy had failed, the regime's ideology was completely bankrupt, as were the coffers. They had no money.
It's so, you paint a picture through the stories of these defectors of a country almost grinding to a halt. As you write, North Korea just sort of fades to black. You can't even see it on satellite images because when the Soviet Union collapses, there goes the cheap fuel. There goes the electricity. People start stealing copper off the electrical wires. So there's literally no light in North Korea at night.
That's right. North Koreans often tell me about, you know, how you could walk down the street and you would maybe only know somebody was there because you could see the tip of their cigarette glowing. You could walk through the city and you'd feel like you were in the desert because the buildings would be swallowed up by the dark.
Can you just tell us some of the things that different people told you that they just accepted as the limbo bar lowers for them? They just all accept it. Just tell us some of the stories.
Well, you know, each and every one of these people can remember the first time they saw a dead body.
Yeah.
Death was just, you know, everywhere. They saw dead bodies by the side of the road in the train station. People rode in train cars and would find that the person sitting in their compartment was dead. I was very moved by this kindergarten teacher whose pupils begin to die of starvation. And, you know, one by one, these 5 and 6-year-olds, you know, they get skinny, their hair turns brittle and yellowish, their eyes are sunken, they put their heads on their desk, they fall asleep in class. And, you know, as she said, if there was just one of them, you know, the teachers would go to the family's house and try to help them. But there were so many that they steeled themselves to ignore it. And this person today is racked by terrible guilt, but she learned not to really care when she saw a starving child. She learned not to want to share her own food, and that was a survival instinct.
Hmm. Well, and the teacher Miran does survive and defect. That's journalist Barbara Demick. Her book is Nothing to Envy, Ordinary Lives in North Korea. We're going to have more after a break. And later today, those alleged Russian spies growing hydrangeas in New Jersey, selling homes in Massachusetts? Back in a minute, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back, or if you've just tuned in, we've been hearing what it's like to live in oppressive and secretive North Korea through the stories of 6 defectors, including a factory worker, a government loyalist named Mrs. Song, and a student named Jung Sang, who secretly met with his girlfriend Moran for 13 years, during which time they barely kissed. All were profiled by journalist Barbara Demick in her book, Nothing to Envy, Ordinary Lives in North Korea. We're revisiting a conversation we had with her earlier this year. She told us that by 2001, nearly 100,000 North Koreans had left for China. Some of them ended up in South Korea. And each of the defectors Barbara spoke with had a moment where they realized the government was lying to them. They saw the light. We asked Barbara to give us some examples of what set that light bulb off.
There was one North Korean who told me he saw a propaganda photo of South Korean striking workers, and I think this was in the newspaper, and it was supposed to show how oppressed the workers were in South Korea, and it showed a guy with his fist up. But what this North Korean saw was he saw that this oppressed South Korean worker had a jacket with a zipper, which was a great luxury at that time, that in a pocket he had a ballpoint pen, you know, unimaginable for anybody but the richest North Korean, and also that the South Korean worker was protesting. And this man was completely swayed. Another North Korean I met worked for the fishing ministry. And one day they confiscated a Chinese fishing boat that was in illegal waters. And on that boat was a radio. They turned on the radio and they picked up a broadcast from South Korea of a radio comedy. There were two young women who were fighting about a parking space. And the man was completely confused. He had never heard of anybody who owned their own car.
Yeah.
And a few years later, he defected.
I love the story you tell about Jun Sang. Again, this is the student who loved to read and started picking up books like Dale Carnegie's books. And he can't believe that Dale Carnegie is talking about learn to love, respect, and enjoy other people. What? He thought capitalists could never do anything like that. But he also got a television set, and he rigged it up so that he could watch it without the Electric Wave Inspection Bureau police figuring out that he was seeing something from outside the state-run North Korean television. And I love the scene where he first hears Kim Jong-il.
Yeah, that's right.
Speaking.
Because Kim Jong-il's voice is not broadcast inside North Korea. That's one of the ways that you keep the sense of this man as God. They had never heard Kim Jong-il's voice, and the occasion was the South Korean president, Kim Dae-jung, had come to Pyongyang, and Kim Jong-il was saying, you know, here are our monuments and here are our museums. He was just an ordinary person, and it's my God. He was human.
But then for your defectors becomes another hard time. Once the light bulb goes off, they can't tell anyone.
That's right. Jun Song realizes that he doesn't believe anymore, but he can't tell the person he's closest to, Miran, his girlfriend, and really his best friend. It's too risky. It would endanger her life, her safety. And he doesn't tell her. And at the same time, she doesn't tell him that she's also thinking about defecting from North Korea.
In fact, she leaves first. And it's so sad because you realize if they'd spoken, they might have left together and had a life together. And just as they leave, it's shockingly easy. They find that there are people willing to guide them to a spot where they can walk into China. So, Barbara Demick, what do you take from this story of North Korea? If more people knew, would more people leave? What's your sense of that?
I think a lot of people do know. And a lot of people do leave, but once they get to China, the Chinese will hunt them down, and then they're in more trouble than they were to begin with.
Well, that's one downside, but also their lives are in such limbo. I mean, it's not just that they, you know, Mrs. Song arrives in South Korea in the bathroom in the airport. She doesn't know how to use the flush, but they really are in just a sort of limbo.
That's right. And, you know, there are many North Korean defectors have told me that they regretted leaving. You know, these people, too, they love their country. They have their criticism with the leadership, but North Korea is their home. And, you know, one thing that happens is, and this especially happened to the defectors who left in the 90s, when they left, their relatives left behind were punished. So I tell you, there are many North Koreans, and I've met some of them, who still live in North Korea, and they know. They know their regime is bankrupt. They know life is better on the outside. But they go back for their families, and, you know, they also know that it's not going to be easy for them once they leave.
Journalist Barbara Demick, author of Nothing to Envy, Ordinary Lives in North Korea. We spoke with her earlier this year when her book first came out. And this note, yesterday music critic and fanatic Steve Allman gave us a list of his listening picks, and we asked, what's on your playlist? Well, hoo boy, did we get an earful. The dog days are over. The dog days are done. That's The Dog Days Are Over by Florence and the Machine. It was tweeted from Lavita Dionita.
Fell through the cracks at the end of our street. Let's go to the beach, get the sand through our feet.
Let's stay with our tweets. Echo 75 suggested Sarah McLachlan's Bring on the Wonder. Echo 75 says that's about vacation and recharging.
For too long. Bring on the wonder. We got it all wrong. Revolting is how you make me feel.
And Luvi Kavi is listening to Hungry Lucy. Here's a bit of the song You Are. Well, keep them coming. We need a new summer soundtrack. You can also follow us on Twitter at Here and Now, or go to hereandnow.org and click on What Are You Listening to read the list or to add to it. That's hereandnow.org. Just click on What Are You Listening to? Still ahead, if you're trying to teach a Russian spy to sound like an American, well, of course you'd teach them to debate the Super Bowl and other revelations from that FBI sting of an alleged Russian spy ring. But the latest news is next, Here and Now. Today, during a hearing on his nomination to lead the war in Afghanistan, General David Petraeus told a Senate committee that the nearly 9-year war may get tougher and more intense in the coming months. Of course, President Obama picked Petraeus to replace General Stanley McChrystal after that Rolling Stone article last week. And shortly after that story exploded, a block of House Democrats, joined by some Republicans, sent a letter to House Speaker Nancy Pelosi asking her to hold off on war funding until some of the claims in the article can be explained. But Defense Secretary Robert Gates says funding has to be approved this week because the military is running out of money. Congressman Jim McGovern joins us from Washington. Congressman, you spearheaded this letter to Pelosi. What was in that article that jumped out at you?
Well, the thing that bothered me the most was not the comments by General McChrystal, although they were very inappropriate. What bothered me the most were the comments by senior military advisors that said if the American people really paid attention to what was happening in Afghanistan, the war would be even more unpopular. And there was another reference to the fact that the military believes that there's no way we're going to begin a withdrawal next July, as President Obama had promised in his West Point speech several months ago. In fact, that they were going to ask for another surge of troops. We're going to have 100,000 American forces there by the end of the month. I mean, how many more troops are we going to be asked to fund? So what we have suggested is that everything be held off until we can have a full and thorough debate, until the questions about this war can be answered. And I'm quite frankly concerned that we're engaged in a war that has no end.
Well, and Secretary Gates says that if money isn't approved, the Pentagon might have to do stupid things like furlough civilian Pentagon employees. You know, they say they're running out of money.
Well, first of all, the president in his West Point speech said that we were going to begin a withdrawal beginning in July of 2011. So he clearly wanted to reassure people like me and others who are concerned about the war that there is an end date here, there's an end game.
And more recently, I'm just going to jump in to say he said, well, we didn't say we'd be switching off the lights and closing
right.
The door in July.
So now they're trying to spin it in a whole different way, which has me very concerned because I think we're stuck into a quagmire here where no one can define what success is, where no one can define what winning this war means. I voted after September 11th to go to war in Afghanistan, to go after al-Qaeda. But al-Qaeda has left Afghanistan. They're in Pakistan, they're in Yemen, they're in Somalia. You know, but we are stuck in Afghanistan trying to rid Afghanistan of the Taliban, which is an indigenous group of people who live there. That's where they're from. And we're not having very much success. And we're finding out that the Afghan government is corrupt and incompetent. We're finding that the Afghan military is unreliable. I mean, our troops are fighting with incredible skill, and I'm in awe of their service, but they don't have the backup from the Afghan military. So this is a mess.
Well, and I just want to be clear. Is this about your feelings about the efforts in Afghanistan, or, as some critics are saying, is this about the fact that you and some other Democrats want, I think, upwards of $23 billion in the funding bill to go to prevent teacher layoffs and other domestic spending that you're concerned about?
Well, look, I am all in favor of spending money to prevent teacher layoffs and to extend unemployment benefits.
But is this hijacking war funding for that?
To those who have lost their jobs. But here's what I'm a little bit puzzled by. We're told that we can't extend unemployment benefits to people who have lost their jobs because we can't pay for it. Yet we're being asked to approve this week $33 billion in borrowed money, none of it paid for, to go to Afghanistan. I mean, you know, when it comes to American workers, you know, we have to be tight-fisted with the budget. But when it comes to, you know, funding a corrupt regime led by President Karzai, I mean, we're a bottomless pit. So where are all these fiscal conservatives and deficit hawks who say we need to pay for everything? Well, let's pay for these wars. We're not.
Congressman Jim McGovern, do you think you have the votes to stop the war funding bill?
I don't know where the votes are. I think if it was a secret vote, I think we would have the votes. But the fact is that it's very difficult for members of Congress to go on record voting in favor of ending a war. You know, Lyndon Johnson had it right when he said that it's easy to get into war. It's hard as hell to get out of war. You know, I've seen this movie before, and it doesn't have a happy ending. When the Soviet Union got involved in Afghanistan, that's what brought that country down. It bankrupted them. Yeah. You know, being there for a prolonged period of time, and after being there for 10 years, is not in our national security interest.
Congressman Jim McGovern, Democrat from Massachusetts, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
And, of course, we'll get the other side of that issue in the coming days. Up next, that alleged Russian spy ring in 30 seconds, here and now. It reads like a bad Boris and Natasha scene from the old Rocky and Bullwinkle show. Russian spies trained to wage water cooler debates over the Super Bowl in order to pass as Americans, taught to bury money in paper bags or use Morse code, as the Washington Post blog Spy Talk asks, don't they know about the internet or ATM cards? Well, they apparently do, as we'll hear. But the 11 alleged Russian spies, 10 here in the U.S., one arrested in Cyprus, charged by the U.S. Justice Department, seem to take their cues right out of a bad Cold War novel, living in communities like Cambridge, Massachusetts, Montclair, New Jersey, and Arlington, Virginia. The Russian government has denounced the arrests as unjustified. Let's find out more from Evan Perez, Justice Department correspondent for The Wall Street Journal. And Evan, you know, people are scratching their heads over the methods these alleged spies allegedly used, but what is the FBI saying their mission was?
Well, their mission was to be essentially long-term spies for the Russian government, to be agents for the Russian government, to essentially become Americanized and live sort of ordinary lives, to be able to report back on contacts they made, hopefully in policy-making circles, and to perhaps recruit, you know, other people, other agents who could help the government learn more about U.S. defense and so on.
In fact, the FBI claims to have a message that was sent from Russian handlers to one of the now defendants in 2009, and it reads like a contract. You were sent to USA for a long-term service trip. Your education, bank accounts, car, house, etc., all of these serve as one goal: fulfill your main mission to search and develop ties in policymaking circles in U.S. and send intelligence reports to Moscow. Things like this, though, have people saying, you what? You sent the message out where the FBI could pick it up? What's the sense of some of this information the FBI claims to have?
Well, the FBI seems to have gotten onto these folks perhaps up as long as 10 years ago, and they've been watching. They've been able to get into their apartments and their homes, to photograph, to put wires inside the homes, video surveillance, to check on all their methods on the computers and so on. So they've been watching this for some time. And so what's been puzzling about this is the quality of the information that the FBI says they seem to have gotten. It's not very impressive. It's stuff that you maybe could have gotten from Google and gone through a lot less trouble to get.
Well, as you said, they've been following the case for years, but we understand a critical point came over the weekend. Two FBI agents posing as Russian agents, they were also doubling back on the alleged spies. And they gave two of the defendants an espionage-related delivery to make. Now, what happened there? Because we understand one made it, one didn't.
Right. They were apparently supposed to deliver a computer back to Moscow. And essentially, the FBI became concerned that at least one of them was planning to go back to Russia and not return. And so there became some concern about rolling this up to make sure that they got everybody that they knew they had. That's the reason why this operation was brought to a close.
As we know, President Obama hosted the Russian President Medvedev just last week, and he was supposed to be restarting Russian-U.S. relations. And as we said, the Russian government has denounced the arrests as unjustified. But What is the sense of how this reflects on what relations really are?
Well, I mean, you know, it's funny. We talked to the officials in the administration, and essentially, the president was aware of the FBI operation, and it seems that the State Department and the administration in general views this as just part of the normal relationship we have with Russia nowadays. You know, they have spies here, we have spies there. It's sort of like a grown-up adult relationship. You have to obviously protest when you're caught, and you pretend like, you know, there was no there. It's funny that Medvedev and President Obama were munching on hamburgers in Arlington, mm-hmm. just down the road from where one of these alleged agents lived in an apartment building. So it's part of the relationship, and it doesn't look like it's going to meaningfully, you know, hurt relationships or affect it in any way.
Well, especially because it does seem so goofy, but you say, you know, it's something that everybody accepts, so it still raises the question, why? You know, why was it triggered now? And we just called up Marshall Goldman, who's, of course, at the Harvard Davis Center for Russian Studies. He said, well, you know, there might be a possibility that someone in Washington or in the FBI didn't like the fact that the Obama administration was, you know, having hamburgers with the Russian president and maybe exposed this sort of ongoing cat and mouse game to underscore that, you know, Russia is still spying on the U.S.
Right, and there's a lot inside the administration, inside the government, especially in the career ranks at the State Department and in the FBI and other places that focus on Russia. There's a lot of concern about the influence of organized crime, and so on. So there is there's a lot of nervousness about what exactly Russia is up to. So some of that is at play, definitely.
And as we said, despite the Boris and Natasha nature of some of the methods that were used, there could be serious consequences. We're looking at the case of Donald Heathfield and his wife, Tracy Foley, and the, you know, there's quotations around wife because some of these people were put together as couples, but she was a licensed real estate agent here in the Cambridge area. He had an international consulting and management development firm. They were right in the middle of an area that has biotech, the Harvard Kennedy School. So what is the sense of what they might have been doing?
The FBI captured some of the communications, which seemed to indicate that they were sending information back about some of the important people they met. It's also interesting, too, though, that some of what the FBI captures appears to be them bluffing and basically sort of exaggerating the importance of what they were getting. Their handlers in Moscow send them a note back saying, good job, you're doing a good job, it's very, very important what you're getting. But a lot of that stuff you could get in other ways, especially, you know, as good as the Russians have become on cyber spying.
Well, and the FBI claims that this couple in Massachusetts was looking for information on U.S. nuclear weapons. Obviously, that has serious consequences. But in Montclair, New Jersey, you had Cynthia and Richard Murphy. One of their neighbors said that she couldn't possibly be a spy. Look at what she did with the hydrangeas.
Right, so, exactly.
I mean, what is the sense of where this goes? And, Evan, one last question we had. The FBI is alleging that some of these people were sort of put together as perfect American families, but they did have children. What
right.
happens to them?
As far as the FBI is aware, there's no indication that the kids knew what their parents were up to, that their parents were actually Russians posing as Americans. Now, these kids are American, obviously, and, you know, who takes custody of them? I don't think that's known right at this moment. Mm-hmm. You know, in some ways, you know, some of this takes you back to Nelson DeMille's novel from the 90s called The Charm School, which talks about something exactly like this, where you have these Russian agents training to be perfect Americans.
Well, and it's fascinating if it's in a novel, and it's funny if it's a movie. I'm thinking of Spy Kids, but how heartbreaking if it's true and it's real. Evan Perez, Justice Department correspondent for The Wall Street Journal. We'll continue to follow this story. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Robin.
As you're preparing to embark on your summer vacation, you might want to consider the jogger in Idaho Springs, Colorado, who was disemboweled by a cougar. Or remember Bill Bryson's story in his book, A Walk in the Woods, about the mom in the national park who smeared her son's hand with honey to get a picture of him playing with a black bear, which promptly ate his hand. There are, of course, sharks to think about. And don't get me started on the platypus. Gordon Grice has collected a gasp-inducing series of stories about the hazards that the animal kingdom can pose in his new book, Deadly Kingdom, The Book of Dangerous Animals. And he joins us from Minnesota Public Radio with more. Welcome.
Hi, thanks.
And I have to sort of start where you end in the book, because as I read story after story, I started feeling like I wanted to defend the animals. I started thinking, yeah, but, you know, we're still the biggest killer. And you say that.
Yeah, we're the biggest killers of ourselves, first of all, but also of every other species. We're the worst. So this whole book, horrifying as it can be at times, is the footnote. It's, you know, when the other animals come out on top.
And even then, I mean, we have to remind ourselves that sharks are about maybe 100 shark attacks a year. 14 or 15 of those are fatal. Horrible. But that's still a fraction.
It's a tiny fraction, of course. Also, in comparing the number of shark attacks to the number of chances that we have for shark attacks, they very rarely attack. Even the great white, which is a, you know, one of the most dangerous species, very rarely chooses to attack a human.
And we read these incredible stories. You know, oh, there's the one after World War II. A ship is sunk. There are over 800 men in the water. You write an incredible paragraph, it's on page 68, of what happened to those men that were taken by sharks.
Men sped across the face of the water, propelled by unseen sharks. Others bobbed in the water as if asleep. On closer inspection, they were found to be missing their lower halves. Some were dragged down suddenly, never to reappear. Their empty life jackets might float up moments later.
Okay, so... You know, I get to that point and it just reaffirms my fear, although, as we've said, it is rare. But as you tell all the stories, is there anything you learn that people can learn from? I mean, is there anything you can do about shark attacks?
There are a lot of things. And, you know, with each specific animal, there are different safety procedures. In the case of the Indianapolis, which is what I was just reading about, it was the combat that made them vulnerable to the sharks.
Right.
And this happened several times in World War II or the Battle of Guadalcanal, for example. Men going into the water, bleeding. This is a smorgasbord for predators and scavengers.
Well, what about bear attacks, though?
Bears attack for many different reasons. And there are different species of bears, and each animal has its own way of communicating, and a lot of our problems happen when we don't understand that communication. So, for example, with the brown bear, including grizzlies that we're familiar with in the U.S., oftentimes those bears attack out of a sense that we've violated their territory or the sense that we are challenging them. When we look at them and they look back and we don't look away, that's a challenge. That's a threat to them. And so, you know, you're looking at a bear trying to get a nice photo and it thinks you want to hurt it. So it's no surprise then that it comes and attacks you.
Right. And you, in fact, say in North America, there's been a culture of extermination of animals, animals that are thought to be dangerous or maybe for food. But this teaches animals to perceive humans as a threat, which might increase the chances of them attacking. And even the common house pet, the dog, they will try to raise their status in the household if they haven't been appropriately trained by attacking children or even adults that, you know, are bending over so they see them as being smaller.
Yeah, they have a very well-defined sense of hierarchy, dogs do. And, you know, when we don't understand what their hierarchy is, then sometimes we can run into trouble. For example, a badly trained or aggressive dog that sees that adult just, you know, picking up the newspaper off the floor, that's an opportunity for that dog to use aggression to overcome that adult and then be higher in the pecking order within the family. He perceives himself as part of this human family.
Yeah. And, of course, people who work with dangerous animals are in particularly in danger. You talk a lot about snakes and snake researchers, including a 20-year-old Australian named Kevin Budden.
Yeah, he was a very important figure in the history of research on venoms. He gathered the first taipan that scientists had been able to use to develop an antivenin for that particular snake. The taipan is... its bite is so venomous and it injects such a large quantity of venom that it's often fatal. And so at this point in 1950, when Budden was hunting for this snake, he purposely meant to collect one for this research. And he did, but he was holding it in his hand and he knew how to hold it. He knew how to grab it behind the head so that it couldn't bite him. But he simply wore out and it got a couple of bites on his hand and he died of it.
Yeah, well, and before dying, asked that the snake not be killed so it could be used for research. And there was another herpetologist, same thing, bitten by another snake. And since he was the expert deep in the jungle, he had to tell the people traveling with him what to expect, what happened from the bite, and what to do.
He knew what was happening to him, and he quickly lost his ability to speak, but he could still write, and so he could instruct people on how to take care of him. Eventually, he was completely paralyzed, but his mind was active, and he was instructing his colleagues on how to give him mouth-to-mouth resuscitation and so forth. They did that for quite a long time, I think nearly to the point of exhaustion. Sort of a heartbreaking incident, because the last thing that he wrote was, "Let me die." Yeah. And they had to finally accede to his request.
I tell you, you read these stories, and as I said, it's gasp-inducing, it's stomach-clenching, but it's rare. It continues to be rare. But since you do talk so much about snakes, let's say someone's going, hiking in Utah this summer. What, you know, just for the average person, not deep in a jungle, what is the one piece of advice you'd want to give people about snakes?
People who, you know, work in the medical field or the poison control field will tell you the best remedy for snake bite is a set of car keys. In other words, get to help as soon as you can if you get a snake bite. Mm-hmm. Even better, though, is to be educated about what the wildlife is in the area where you want to go hiking. I don't mean to scare anybody away from going into the outdoors, especially in the U.S. where, you know, relatively speaking, we're pretty safe. But if you're going hiking, for example, in Utah, educate yourself. You know, phone the national park or the, you know, whatever place you're going, or look on the internet and find out what wildlife you're going to encounter. Mm-hmm. For example, the rattlesnakes of Utah typically will make a warning buzz. If you're alert and listen for the cues that the environment is giving you, it's very unlikely that you would have any problem.
And Gordon Grice, what about you? You're one of those people, I'm guessing a lot of people know someone like you. You know, your fascination with animals began early on, finding little baby mice. And so what is it about these that are so frightening to so many people that fascinate you?
I honestly don't know. I think partly it is the fear factor, the fact that that's just part of the fascination, that this is something that could hurt you if you weren't careful with it.
Well, but it feels as if that fascination, whatever it is, also comes from a longing almost for the order to be kept, that in fact there should be mystery and fear and danger and respect for the animal kingdom.
I definitely think there should be respect for the animal kingdom. In the U.S., we have things so easy. For example, when a cougar kills a person, it gets hunted down very quickly and killed, and we don't have to live in fear. But there are parts of the world where, you know, for example, tigers, lions, leopards sometimes prey on people, and sometimes those people are powerless to do anything about it.
And as you said, in this part of the world, the biggest predator is us.
That's true everywhere in the world. The human being is always the most dangerous animal.
Gordon Grice, his new book is Deadly Kingdom, The Book of Dangerous Animals. It's a fascinating read and very scientific in its approach. Gordon, thanks so much.
Thank you.